Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, clinician in rabbit, exotic animal and wildlife medicine and surgery, Bronwyn Cotterwas. Thank you, Bronwyn. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks so much for having me today. It's really good to be a part of the Exotics Webinar Club, and I'm really excited to talk to you today about zoo animals as a part of your small animal or mixed animal practice first opinion caseload. So you might be lucky enough to have a zoo on the books already, or maybe there's a local collection that you want to approach. But hopefully this webinar will inform you on a lot of different aspects, not just the fun veterinary medicine bit, so that you have the most successful, rewarding relationship. Just to kind of set the groundwork to get us started, I'll walk you through the outline for today. We'll start by talking about what exactly is a zoo. We'll define some really important terms, and then we'll spend a lot of time talking about the legislation and the best practices around zoo work. That's going to be really, really important. We'll also talk about building relationships. Who do you need to gain the trust of? Who do you need to get in your camp so that you can practice the kind of veterinary medicine that you want to practice? And then a little bit more of the familiar stuff. We'll talk about getting your practice prepared to treat a zoo. What kind of supplies might you need? What might you need to think about for you and your staff? And then we'll talk also about specific aspects of veterinary medicine in zoo work. And then we'll do a bit of a summary at the end. So starting with what is a zoo, it might seem a bit silly to define it, but it's really important. And when some of us think about zoo animals, we typically think about the big ones, don't we? These iconic zoo animals. But we have to remember that it might also involve the ones that aren't such big ticket items. And who defines what a zoo animal is? Well, so far the government right now has a definition that a zoo animal is an animal that's not commonly domesticated in the UK, and a zoo is an institution or a collection that publicly exhibits that kind of animal for 7 or more days in a year. Now, you can imagine that the definition of a commonly domesticated animal might change, and what does it mean to be publicly exhibited? Also, the 7 or more days in a year, that doesn't have to be paid entry. That can be free access. So you have to remember these kind of key bits when it's defining a zoo and a zoo animal. Also remember that this doesn't include circuses or pet shops. And probably something we need to keep referring back to DEFRA and the UK.gov websites to help us in emerging definitions. So just, you can kind of see the confusion if we look over here at some of the not commonly domesticated species. We've got everything from camels and reindeer to giant African land snails, so quite a variety. And you can imagine maybe that years down the road, maybe camels or reindeer might be considered more of a domesticated species. So it's kind of watch this space. As I said, to kind of keep yourself current, make sure you do check out the websites that I'll have linked to this webinar. Moving on now, we'll talk about the legislation and the best practices. And again, I'll probably spend most of the time on this bit because it's really quite important that you're following the law and again, practicing a high standard of veterinary medicine. First of all, in this section, we'll start talking about the Animal Welfare Act. Hopefully, we're all familiar with this as practicing veterinarians already. But it'll inform the other bits of a law that we'll interact with later on. We'll talk about the Zoo Licensing Act, the Standards of Modern Zoo Practice, which is a wonderful document. I refer to this quite a bit. There's a lot of good guidelines in it. Also the EU document that's similar, and then some other terms you might come across like CITES and BALAI. Beginning with the Animal Welfare Act, again, we should all really be familiar with it. It's about the health and welfare of animals in our care. But some key differences with regard to zoo animals might be when we're thinking about an offence. It's an offence if someone acts or fails to act to cause the suffering of an animal. And then the other thing to remember as well is what is good practice when we're talking about providing the welfare, good welfare for an animal. And that will come back to the standard of zoo practice. Again, here, make sure you keep up to date on Animal Welfare Act. The Zoo Licensing Act is the most important act that we're going to talk about in terms of zoos obtaining their licenses, being considered a zoo, and keeping up with their licensure. So it's under the remit of the local authority or local council, not only just to decide what collection constitutes a zoo, so what grouping of animals will be a zoo or what group of animals is publicly displayed, but also what of those animals continue to be zoo animals. So it's really up to the local authority. And they also do perform regular inspections. It's at different frequencies depending on how newly licensed the zoo is. But again, you'll be guided by hopefully the local council committee on that. So again, this little section will talk about the standards of modern zoo practice. And again, this is a really, really important guidebook. And I do refer to it quite a bit in all of the zoo guidance that I provide. The most, I guess the newest document, it was just put out in 2012. It was just updated by DEFRA then, and you can download a PDF of it. But this document is used by the zoo councils, the city councils or local authorities when they come to inspect the zoos. In the standard of modern zoo practice, they begin by talking about the five freedoms, and we all know what the five freedoms are. We deal with them every day in our small and mixed animal practices in our daily life as vets. But we need to think about what the differences are for zoo animals when it comes to providing these freedoms. We know about providing hunger or freedom from hunger and thirst, but how does that apply to a zoo animal who might forage for food as part of an enrichment plan or access water in a different way? What is an appropriate diet? There's not commercially available diets for every zoo animal, although there are a lot of zoo nutritionists out there. What constitutes an appropriate diet? Who decides that? The freedom from discomfort. Does the zoo animal in its enclosure have a suitable area to get rest, have shelter from the public? And is there also a similar environment off show or indoors that provides that? And then we need to provide the freedom from pain, injury, and disease. And of course, this is where we as vets come into play. And this needs to be done in a timely way. We need to be able to respond to emergencies appropriately, even when it's on zoo grounds or in a zoo collection or even at night. The animal needs to be able to exhibit normal behaviors, and with zoo or exotic species, this can be a little bit different. Again, there are a lot of resources out there, a lot of behaviorists to tap into and what constitutes normal behaviors for zoo species, but this is really going to inform our exhibit design, making sure they have enough space and that they're utilizing that space in a way that's natural for that species. And then finally, the fifth freedom is the freedom from fear and distress. And importantly for zoo species, I mentioned it just briefly earlier, but it is important for them to have comfortable areas off show where they can relax, they can hide away and not have any distress, not only from maybe the public being around, but also other animals. If it's a multi-species exhibit or if they have other cohorts in that exhibit, they need to be able to hide away. So the Standards of Modern Zoo Practices advises on quite a few things, really. It talks about not only safety of the public, but also staff, what kind of facilities are needed, again, not only for the public, but for the animals, important aspects of record keeping, which are going to be legal requirements, and then also employee training, just making sure that the staff involved with not only the public, but the animals have the best training possible. And here's the important bit. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about the veterinary requirements that are outlined as a guide in the Standards of Modern Zoo Practice. We're going to talk about kind of regular inspections, what constitutes routine veterinary care, who decides what that is, and what is more specialist veterinary care. Finally, we'll talk a little bit about emergency cover as well. So when it comes to regular inspections, how do we decide how often we need to visit a zoo? Who decides that? I'm sure some of us would love to go every day or every week, but we're charging a fee for this, for these clients. Obviously, they're working on a budget, whether they're charitable organization or for-profit. So we need to be sensible about how often we're going to visit the collection. And you can see by this diagram, for large zoos, that might be a weekly endeavor. Medium zoos, a little bit less frequent, every other week. And large bird parks, maybe just once a month. And we have to remember aquaria as well, smaller bird parks. We might just be going every other month. But to be honest, for most zoos, for most small zoos, we're going every 3 months to visit and make sure that we're inspecting not only the health status of every animal that we in the collection, but also the exhibit. Have there been any changes in nutrition? Have there been any welfare changes? And it's also a good chance to talk about collection planning and the overall preventative medicine program. Routine veterinary care involves not only treating sick animals that we know about, but also carrying out that preventative medicine program that's worming, vaccinating, any routine treatments that need to be done. Also, sample collection and analysis, you know, that's really going to be helpful often when we can't get our hands on an animal. It's easy enough to get a fecal sample and we can monitor worming status or perhaps some other samples. If there's exudate from a wound, we can train keepers on how to collect that kind of sample for us. And then it's also important on it to advise on euthanasia. What are the euthanasia criteria for the zoo? Are they talking about euthanizing just animals in poor health that have a grave prognosis? Or is it more of a larger collection plan? Are we talking about surplus animals? And that can be a bit of a tricky subject. So this is something that you want to have really clear in the beginning. There might be more specialist veterinary care involved, and this might be carried out by a consultant zoo vet or zoo vet group. So this might not necessarily fall under your remit, but just be aware that this is going to be a requirement by the veterinary program. So not only in carrying out the preventative medicine program that we talked about before, but also formulating that, defining it and revising it year on year. It might be a zoo that's larger and has some quarantine facilities and the specialist vet might be involved in inspecting that. Also advising on diets and nutrition and how that might evolve with the animal collection. exhibit design and collection planning we've talked about, but also performing postmortem examinations. Now, this might be something you can do that you do already in your practice, and that you could provide this service for the zoo as well, because every animal that that's part of the collection that dies on zoo grounds or dies must have a postmortem performed. And finally, in this bit of the section, we need to talk about emergency cover. So we know that the MRCVS Code of Professional Conduct that we all must follow recently has had some changes with regard to emergency cover. And this applies to our zoo clients as well. So we must have some kind of plan in place. We must have taken some steps to provide 24-hour emergency care. Now, this doesn't mean that you need to provide it directly, but you need to have some way of providing care for that zoo at all times. The EU Zoos Directive Good Practices document really mirrors the standards modern practice. So there's a lot of similarities, but a little bit less delineated when it comes to talking about the veterinary program. It basically says there must be a veterinary program. There must be a preventative medicine aspect of it. There must be the facilities to carry that program out. And again, there must be postmortems performed. CITES might be a term you're familiar with or you've come across in the past. And this is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. Now, it's a little bit of legislation that regulates the trade and display of animals that it's listed. And the listed animals are ones that are endangered or under threat of being endangered, or if their environment is continued to be continually exploited, they might be endangered in the future. Now, there are some species that are already on this list that we might deal with on a day-to-day basis in first opinion practice, like some of the chelonia, but there'll be a lot of other species on there as well, of course. And the other term that you might have heard before is BALI. The BALI directive is a little bit more appropriate, or I suppose applicable to the larger zoos, and that it regulates the movement of animals out of the UK, out of the EU, and between member states. It's not only animals, it's animal products as well, so also involved in the movement and transport of semen and embryos. Now, with the BALI documentation, there needs to be a health certificate involved, so you might be called upon as the vet to provide a health certificate if there's going to be transport of an animal or animal products. And as a part of that document, there needs to be a summary of the enclosure design for that animal as well, so that there's some insurance that that's going into a suitable enclosure. So that was a scary bit. That was the legislation. And so we're done with that kind of boring chunk of it. So now we get to have a little bit more fun. In this next section, we're going to talk about building relationships. And it's really, really important just to know who you're dealing with when it comes to the zoo. Who's important? Who has what roles? And that's going to help define your role as well as the zoo vet. So we need to understand the organization of the zoo, have these defined roles so that we can have expectations and try to meet those expectations. What other kind of oversight does the zoo have? That'd be good to know. And then it's always good to know how to get more information. So most zoos that are part of that practice a good high standard have these main goals. This is their mission. They're not only providing a good environment for the health and welfare of the animals in their care, but they also have a real responsibility for public education, conservation programs, not only locally, but abroad as well, that feed into helping out the animals or the species in their collection. And then also, there might be breeding programs. Now, there might not be in the particular collection that you're dealing with. They might have decided not to be involved, but on the other hand, there might be as well, and you need to be aware that that might be something you need to deal with in the future. The overall structure of the zoo, there's always a director, and the director might not be somebody who has a lot of animal experience. It might not be somebody who's a veterinarian. This might just be somebody who's called in because they've got good managerial skills or good directorship skills. But then again, they might also have some animal experience. So it's good to get the director on your side so that you can have the budget that you need to for performing your veterinary care that you want to do. Underneath the director are the curators. There's almost always a general curator that guides the other curators, and those will essentially be the heads of each kind of animal section or animal department. And under the curators comes the keeper, so the day-to-day person who has the contact with the animal. And this will be the equivalent to the owners that we interact with in private practice. So these keepers are going to be the ones that you're getting the histories from. They're going to know their animal really, really well because they see them every single day. So these are the people who, and these are the ones who are going to be carrying out the medical treatments or helping with the procedures that you want to perform. Just remember that all of these people, especially the keepers, have gone through a lot of training to come to where they are in most cases. So some of these people might have doctorates or PhDs or master's degrees in ecology, conservation ecology, and biology. There are actual keepers colleges as well. So they might have gone through a keeper college training program and are functioning at a really high level or really knowledgeable about the biology of the animals in their care. On the other hand, in some smaller zoos, it might be people, keepers just starting out in their career, and so they might need a little bit more training and guidance from you. So it's good to kind of know the level of training, experiential background of the keepers that you're working with. The zoo, not only the legislation that we've talked about before, but the zoo is also going to be overseen by some other regulating bodies. So the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or BIAZA, is a kind of a membership that high-functioning zoos can go for. There's over 100 UK zoos that are members at the moment. So not every single zoo has to be a BIAZA member, but it basically just shows that they're following a high standard of animal care and that they're committed to conservation and public education. So now we'll talk about defined roles a little bit. Really, what's important for you to do? What's important for you to communicate that you want to do with the collection? And what does that zoo need from you as well? Again, they're going to have a budget that they need to be cognizant of, and have make sure that they are funding you in a way that you can. So that's also going to inform how much you might be able to do at times. Make sure that you communicate how often you're going to visit the zoo and how often you might have zoo animals brought to you as well. How much can be done on site? How much can be done by the keepers? How much training can you do that might minimize how frequently you have to go and do a visit? Will you be a vet that's a part of the ethics and welfare committee? Every zoo must have an ethics and welfare committee, and that meets once yearly, and oftentimes the vet is a part of that as well. Are you formulating the preventative medicine program, or is another vet? Is there a consultancy, consultant that's coming in and doing that for you? We've talked about the emergency out of hours cover already, but it's good to reinforce with the zoo what the plan is. How often are you going to have a chance to actually analyze samples? We've got the budget to think about, so you're not going to be able to do everything you want sometimes. But we need to be a bit opportunistic and be the most efficient with the samples that we do have. And really, really important, you need to talk about some kind of emergency escape plan with the zoo staff. Now, they're already going to have probably an emergency escape plan in play. That's part of getting their licensure. But you're going to be involved with it as the zoo vet, so it's good that you know what their plan is. You could be involved in drills, and obviously you might be keeping some of the medication or some of the pharmaceuticals to capture animals when they accidentally get out of where they're meant to be. Zoos are also guided by advisory groups. So BIOSA has a taxon advisory group for each group of animals that not only has husbandry manuals but also kind of long-term goals for those animals. Also, which individuals might go to which zoos for the best breeding program. And another group is called the Species Survival Plan. And then international stud books are again to advise on the breeding program for each species. The local council obviously is going to have oversight in the zoo because they've been giving them the zoo license. So just be aware that you at one point will probably need to have a relationship with the local council and their group that's in charge of the zoo. And then the police. It's also a good idea just to make yourself known to the local police just in case there is an emergency, an accident, just so they know where you're coming from. Other resources that are going to be really important for you as a vet is finding out more information or other zoo vet organizations, and BVZS is the common one here. Like I mentioned before, there are also consultancy zoo services that you might tap into when it comes to more specialty care or information or specific concerns that you might have with an individual because they'll have a lot of experience. They might be MRCVS specialists as well that you can talk to. Local referral practices are a good place also just for some not only advice but perhaps using some more specialized equipment or getting people involved in a particular animal or procedure, not only for that animal's benefit but for them as well. It might be a learning experience for them. And the same goes for vet schools. If you're lucky enough to have a vet school nearby, it might always be a great opportunity to have access, sometimes at a reduced rate, to some really good equipment and some extra help when it comes to time for procedures. In the next little section, we're going to talk about how you can get yourself, your staff, and your practice ready for zoo work specifically. We'll talk about the training involved, some actual details of equipment, what facilities the zoo has to have, and then record keeping. In terms of training, you need to think about the collection that you're involved with. What kind of species does that zoo have? And if you're not familiar with that species, then you need to find out. And that can be done by just talking to the zoo staff, the curators, or the keepers. You might have to get specific CPD, and you might have to have some of your staff engage in that as well. And you need to look into official veterinarian status. Just make sure you're on the right panels. So as part of a mixed or small animal practice, you might already have some of the panels. You might already be doing TB testing or pet passport work. And so you might already have some of these panels. But if you're doing zoo work, then you need to make sure you're having additional panels as a part of your OV status. What facilities will you need at your practice? Now, it's not just kind of the brick and mortar stuff, but also the supplies. What are you going to do to transport an animal from point A to point B? Now, the zoo probably already has quite a lot of this in place already, but it's something you need to think about. How will the zoo van access your surgery when it's coming with an animal? Or how will you move an animal in your practice from one place to another? What kind of cages might you need? What kind of restraint equipment might you need that can contain that animal well? Will you need nets? Will you need extra gloves? You just need to think about what you will have to get based on that species. And then think about field work as well. We're all used to performing surgery in our own practice, but what about when it comes to doing work out in the field? Is your equipment portable? Do the batteries work? Are they charged? The people who are already doing large animal work will already be used to this, but if you're just primarily doing small animal work, you need to think about how you're going to take your practice to the zoo if needed. Zoo facilities is pretty well delineated in the Zoo Licensing Act what the zoo needs to have. So make sure that when you're doing zoo inspections, whether it's quarterly or more frequently than that, that you are making sure these are all in good nick. So there needs to be an examination table if appropriate. If it's a collection that doesn't have that just has large hoof stock or larger animals, then an exam table might not quite work for you. The floor might be fine, but you need to have hot and cold water. There needs to be heat and ventilation, light and power. It needs to be cleanable. There needs to be good hygiene. And there needs to be, in this animal treatment area, there needs to be a place to safely store drugs as well. And make sure that when you are inspecting the zoo or you're coming around for your routine visits, that you're making sure these medications are in date. It might not sound like the most fun thing to think about, but record keeping, it is a legal requirement. We do this all the time when it's taking notes or doing SOAPs for our clients or patients in private practice, but it needs to be just as rigorous when it comes to zoo work. Now, in some really small zoos, that might just be a handwritten note and diary. They might just have a calendar that you're writing brief notes on and then transcribing it later on, but there needs to be some way that you're communicating you've actually done a visit, kind of a little bit about what you've done during that visit, and any specifics about animal health or individuals that you've addressed during that visit. Now, you might already use a veterinary management system or computer program at your hospital, so you could use that. You could just enter the zoo as one of the clients, or it might be a zoo-based computer program, and some of the larger zoos might already be a part of a more global zoo computer management system. Certainly, if they're a BIAS member, they'll have access to a computer program or a web-based program called ZIMS or Species 360. And this is a place where they not only monitor, keep track of animal movements and individual descriptions and what the animal's eaten and things like that, births and deaths, but it's also going to be a place where they record medical information. Now, this can come in really, really handy when you come across a species you're not so familiar with. You might ask the curator or the keepers to pull up some information from ZIMS or Species 360 at another institution on the same species, and that might kind of inform you about what to do with these particular individuals, or it might help you when it comes to thinking about an anesthetic protocol. And the next bit is going to be a little bit more fun. So this is the stuff we already know. We're going to talk about veterinary work. You're doing this all the time already, but now we're going to be talking about a little bit more of the details when it comes to zoo work. We're going to talk about some things to think about in terms of diagnostics, maybe some procedures, and then we'll talk a little bit about kind of specific anesthetics, but then kind of the wider approach to sedation and anesthesia in zoo animals. Sample collection. I've spoken about it a little bit earlier, and it's always easy to access a fecal sample from a zoo animal or an exotic animal that's in a captive environment. So we try to do as much as possible with that. It's performing a routine ova and parasite check, just as you would with any species. Now that's going to be wet mount or sediment. You can also do gram staining on it or cultures. So just take advantage, do as much as you can with that, and that might be something that you can do in-house. Maybe you're already doing it with your patients in your practice, which is hopefully the case, because that would save a bit of money, but it might need to be something that you send away as well. The fecal analysis sometimes can be done by the keepers. You can train them up. You can set them up with maybe a secondhand microscope in their veterinary room at the zoo, and they can get quite good at looking at their own fecal samples for ova and parasite, and then inform back to you parasite load, and that can help define your anthelmintic program a little bit better. Your analysis might be a little bit more difficult to get. A lot of keepers are really involved in kind of operant conditioning programs or reinforcing kind of naturalistic behaviors of an animal that might help us as well. So they might be able to actually train an animal to give us a sample, or collect a sample, or even do treatment. So that you might be able to do your analysis. We can do cultures on wounds or abscesses, any discharges, and those cultures might be sent away, or you might be able to do it in-house, hopefully. And cytologies are a really great way of getting a lot of information. So if there's any kind of discharge, just stain it up and look at under a microscope, just as you would do with any of your own patients. If you're not that adept at cytologies, then you can send it away, of course, but this might be something, it's going to affect the budget, so you might need to get permission from the keepers or the curators first before you're sending away samples for analysis. Hematology and biochemistry. Now, we're doing it on a daily basis with small and large animals, but this might be something you're doing a little bit less frequently with zoo animals, just because we don't have access to getting a sample all that readily. It might be something that you're just doing during a procedure. In larger zoos, there are animals that are trained to present a tail or present an arm, and then blood draws can be done stress-free. So it might be something that the institution you're working with might be something that the keepers are interested in trying to do. Again, we've mentioned this already, but who's going to analyze the sample? Will you do it yourself, or will you send it away? And why are we doing these veterinary interventions? Is it because of ill health? Are we just doing routine monitoring? Are we needing to vaccinate or deworm? Or is it a part of a pre-shipment requirement? So when some animals are moved from one zoo collection to another zoo collection, they will go through a quarantine process. And a lot of zoos might ask for certain tests to be done ahead of time, so that can inform the quarantine a little bit more. And they can ensure that that animal is in the best health possible before they're bringing it in and interacting with other individuals in their collection. When we're thinking about veterinary procedures, we're thinking about medications and treatments and potentially even euthanasias, but also postmortem examinations as well. I mentioned that that's a requirement or in the Standard of Zoo Practice Guide and the EU, the similar EU directive. So this might be something that you're going to be involved with. In terms of medicating, sometimes we don't always have an accurate idea of body weight on a zoo animal. You might have to estimate based on just general ranges or kind of your best guess from working with the small or large animals that you already do. But going back, it might also be a good idea to go back to through previous medical records. I mentioned before the ZIMS or Species 360, and that's a really good place to get body weights of animals of the same species of similar ages. So that might really help with your medication. And then hopefully when you have an animal, you're able to weigh it. That will just help you in the future. Or perhaps even the animal can be trained to walk across the scale or sit on a scale by the keeper staff. And that's going to go a long way to ensuring you've got the best medical treatment possible. Will medications be given orally? Will the keeper even be able to give it orally? Or will the animal just refuse to eat that bit of food and eat something else in the enclosure? Or will another individual that's exhibited with that one accidentally get the medication? So we need to think before you just blanket prescribe some oral medication for a zoo animal. You need to think about if it's even practical that that animal's going to get it. It might be a better idea to do an injectable medication. It might be more appropriate given the disease process going on. And again, when it comes to zoo work, you need to think about how often you're going to be having to give those injections. Is it going to pose a risk to the staff or the animal to restrain the animal for injections? Is it going to cause an undue amount of stress? Or perhaps it's going to be an injectable that you can give by a remote delivery system. And that can be a pull syringe or a jab stick, all the way up to kind of darting equipment. And obviously, you're going to need a firearms license to hold any or operate any kind of darting equipment. It's kind of a lengthy process to get a firearms license. You might already have one for the practice that you work in at the moment, but you'll need to add on the particular darting equipment to it. Or it might be that the zoo personnel are holders of the firearm license and that you're just filling the syringe or filling the dart with the pharmaceutical and then somebody else is delivering the dart. We also need to think about choice of medication. If we're going to be going through this process with an animal who's poorly in a zoo, we're hopefully going to give something that, if it's, for instance, an antibiotic, you might want to choose something with a depot effect or that's lasting as long as possible so that you're not having to go back and do repeat injections or repeat darting events very frequently. Think about procedures. There's all sorts of different procedures we can do, but is it practical to do these? Are we again causing undue stress or possibility of injury? Is it in the animal's best interest if this is a chronic or long-term thing? This might be a discussion you need to have with the keepers, the curatorial staff, and maybe even the director to see if it's worth it to keep the animal in the collection. It might seem a simple thing to put a bandage on, but you need to think about what's going to happen when that animal goes off. Are you going to be able to get that bandage off? Are you going to be able to treat it as you want to? Is there going to be problems that that animal encounters because of the procedure or the treatment that you've done? So you need to think about all of these ahead of time. And then, unfortunately, euthanasia—it's something that potentially will happen at the zoo that you're involved with. It might be on an emergency basis, and at which point you need to already have in place a plan for who's going to take care of that in terms of your out-of-hour coverage. Or this might be a planned euthanasia, either because of ill health, age-related disease. Or it might be part of an overall collection plan in terms of stocking density. Now, that might not be your decision. That's probably going to be the zoo's decision when it comes to that. But obviously, you'll inform the environment that the euthanasia takes place. And you might be involved in the postmortem. So again, mentioned this multiple times already, and perhaps you're doing postmortems already in practice. If you're not, then you might need to send away the animal for postmortem, which will be an expense. Or another thing you could do is train up the keeper staff or have them take a course. So the person who performs the postmortem doesn't need to be an MRCVS, they just need to be suitably trained, and then you can advise them on what samples would be best to collect, or make sure they're taking photos or measurements or cultures or samples for histopathology if needed. We'll talk a little bit about, just briefly, about sedation and anesthesia. There are so many resources out there when it comes to particular protocols and individual species. So I just advise, if you are planning an anesthesia for a particular zoo or exotic animal, that you just look in relevant texts or journals. I mentioned before, maybe going through previous medical records and seeing what was done for a similar animal. And then your choice of sedation and anesthesia is also going to be guided by your own experience. What combinations are you comfortable with? Now, you might already be used to dealing with pet cats in your practice, and so extrapolating to an exotic felid, might be fairly simple to do. The ideal drug, we all know about what the ideal anesthetic or sedative is. It's going to be something that's low volume, especially when we're thinking about needing to deliver this by a remote delivery system. So we're going to need to use hopefully we'll have the lowest volume possible to put in our dart that or in our injection that we're giving to the animal. Hopefully it's a product that's safe, not only for the animal, but for people as well, in case there's an accidental exposure. We want an anesthetic that has a wide margin of safety. Now, this kind of harkens back to the body weight scenario, where we might be anesthetizing or dealing with an animal that we're not exactly sure of its body weight at that point in time, that we're just guesstimating a little bit. But we also don't know the health status exactly of the animal. That's what we're anesthetizing them to determine, really. So if we can have the safest drug possible, that would be wonderful. The best anesthetic would be one that antagonizes or reverses well, so that we can have the animal recover quickly and safely and get back to some bit of normalcy. And then we want an anesthetic that has quick onset, especially if you're thinking about an exotic or zoo animal that's not used to being restrained. We'd like to relieve its stress as quickly as possible and have that anesthetized in a short period of time. But also, if you're thinking about a zoo animal that is in a larger enclosure, perhaps it couldn't get into a barn and you're having to anesthetize it out in a field. We don't want that animal to travel very far before the anesthesia is taking effect. We don't want it to get injured. We don't want exertional myopathy to occur. So some sort of anesthetic with a quick onset would be ideal. Now, we all know that that ideal sometimes doesn't always happen, but we try to achieve as close to it as possible. And based on that ideal and perhaps our previous experience, this is a combination that we use quite a lot in zoo animals, so ketamine and medetomidine. And now, there are a lot of other combinations out there. There might be ones that are more opioid-based, using atorphine or large animal immobilon. You might not have access to it. It's a bit difficult to get at times and takes special permitting. So I'm really happy to use this combination with a lot of my zoo work. It can be used on everything from a reptile to a giraffe. And it's something that you probably have experience with using this combination already. And so it's going to be predictable. The Metatomidine, this is just a general guide, and of course you're going to go back and do some research before you're actually anesthetizing the particular species. But as a general guide, Metatomidine, the dose for Metatomidine is about 50 micrograms per kilogram, and the ketamine dose is 5 milligrams per kilogram, and that's delivered in the same syringe at the same time. Metatomidine does come in a more concentrated version, the xaloprazole at 10 mg per mil, so that can help reduce your dose volume. And ketamine is also, it can also present as a powder. It can be lyophilized, which means that you can just add the as much diluent as you want to make it as concentrated as possible. And of course, both of these are, or I'm sorry, the metatomidine is reversed by atipamezole. So there we go. We've got a really good kind of ideal anesthetic protocol. Other combinations that might be used, these might be available to you where you are in your part of the country, or they might not be. Some of them are used more in wildlife, but again, you just need to refer back to journal articles, texts, and best practice for that particular species. This webinar is a little bit too short to talk about veterinary zoological anesthesia in much depth. And finally, we'll end on some key points. I just briefly wanted to talk about publicity. Now, this is kind of the kitchen sink or the odds and sods section of the webinar. But I did think it was important to talk about publicity. You're going to be on display when you're a zoo vet or you're working with a zoo. Their remit is public education and making these amazing exotic species accessible to the public on view. And you might find yourself at times in the public eye. And no, that's absolutely fine. Obviously, we're not worried about the medicine we practice. We don't feel like we need to hide it. But sometimes, if you're working on a particular species, you might get some tunnel vision. You might just be focused on the animal in front of you, and you might not necessarily see what's going on around you. So just be aware what you're doing might need a bit of interpretation by somebody to explain that you're there to help the animal and not hurting it, just so the right message gets out to the public. And the other thing to remember, working with a zoo or an exotics collection is always fun. It's rewarding. It's exciting. People take photos and talk about it. But you need to remember that you must have permission from the zoo to publish anything, whether that's on social media or on your practice website. You must get permission to do that. So just to start to sum up a little bit, obviously we've hit on all of these things in the webinar so far. Working with a zoo collection has a lot of benefits. It's a lot of fun. We get to engage our veterinary brains in a lot of different ways in terms of creative problem solving in the practice and out in the field. But it's also a really good chance to build the skills of your team and to build camaraderie. It's a lovely opportunity to engage in your local link community, make a name for yourself, show that you're interested in the greater community, that you're interested in the public and education and conservation. And it's also a wonderful opportunity to advise on the health and welfare of these exotic species that are kept in collections. So you've got a lot of responsibility, but a wonderful opportunity. So just in summary, just to hit on the key points a little bit, we talked about what a zoo is. That might change down the road, so make sure that you're always looking at or looking referring back to DEFRA, the websites that I've posted in the webinar. This will most often be defined by a local authority, though. What is a zoo? What is a zoo species? You need to understand the Zoo Licensing Act of 1981 because that's going to form the basis of the zoo license, and the guidelines, the standards of modern zoo practice are what that zoo license inspection is going to go from. to have a successful and rewarding relationship, you're going to need to have clear communication and expectations. And you're going to need to get yourself ready. You're going to need to get the appropriate training, train your staff, get the facilities that you might need, bits and bobs of equipment. And really important, keep those records, make notes, communicate, make sure those notes are accessible to other people in your practice or other vets so that they can take over from you if you're not around or if they're providing emergency coverage. And then just remember, you might be working with zoo and exotic species, but the veterinary medicine at its basis is the same, really. We're going to be approaching cases in the same way, performing diagnostics in the same way. Prognoses are going to be very similar as well. Make sure that the safety of the staff and the animals is paramount in any procedure that you're planning. Make sure that when you are performing a procedure or you're involved with a procedure at a zoo or even at your practice, you're thinking about accidental escape. Do you have a contingency plan if that animal accidentally gets away? Are you making sure that it's contained? And you need to think about the day-to-day difficulties in treating that particular animal. You might have to revise your routine treatment plan to make it more applicable for a zoo or exotic species. And then think about your anesthesia. Are you able to do field anesthetic work? If not, you might need to consult or employ one of these zoo consultancy groups. And again, make sure you take care with social media. But the final message is that working with zoo and exotic species is so rewarding, not only from a personal level, but you know that you're doing something for the greater good as well. So again, hopefully this webinar has been helpful. You can refer back to the key points I tried to highlight. And I've just got a question that's come through regarding the Dangerous Wild Animal Act. That's true. I've not talked about the Dangerous Wild Animal Act much or at all in this webinar. And that's really because the Zoo Licensing Act supersedes it. So with the Dangerous Wild Animal Act, that's going to be something that somebody who is a keeper of exotic cat species or primate or a little bit more of a dangerous reptile will have to have a license to hold that dangerous animal. But that's not going to be on public display. So it's just for publicly kept, privately owned animals. So that's why I've not talked about it in this webinar. So that's come to the end of the talk. Again, hopefully you've all enjoyed it. I think we're just in time. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Bronwyn for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.